This is Amicus, a Law Review, and my name is Jim Santel. I'm your host for this podcast on the stations of Civic Media. As always, I'm delighted, I'm honored that you're spending some portion of your week in conversation and an exploration with me of some of the major news stories when it comes to the rule of law, the administration of justice, and the operation of government in our state, in our nation, and occasionally even on the face of our planet. This is the second broadcast, the second podcast of Amicus, a Law Review, in our new format, which is accessible on the Civic Media website. And we're going to be producing one of them virtually every single week. Again, bringing you up to date with perspectives on the rule of law, the administration of government, and the aspiration for justice, focusing specifically on major events, news stories that are animating our lives. During these summertime podcasts, we're going to be spending a lot of time talking about the recent, most significant decisions of our United States Supreme Court. As we know from our last broadcast, there have been about 68 of those during the past term. And yes, we're still in that past term. The current term remains from the 2025 into 2026 term. The Supreme Court starts its new term in early October of this year. That's the 2026-2027 term. And we will talk a little bit today about one of the cases that already populates that docket, coming up for briefing, coming up for oral argument, coming up for review, and ultimately the decision in that next term. But this week, and also for the coming several weeks, we're going to be focusing upon the major cases that the Supreme Court has decided in this current term. They're still active. They're still showing up for work every single week. And there will probably still be some activity coming from the justices on emergency applications and certainly decisions that they're making about populating that next docket in the next term. But for the most part, as of early July, early this month, the Supreme Court is done in resolving its so-called merits cases. As we've discussed before, those are the cases in which the Supreme Court has entertained oral argument. It has solicited from and received from the lawyers representing the litigants in those cases all sorts of briefs, memorandums, sometimes motions as well. Lots of things done during the course of preparing the cases for ultimate decision. And yes, indeed, the Supreme Court has issued just about 65 decisions out of those 68 or so. We're not going to be spending time on each one of those, but probably focusing on somewhere around 15 of those major cases. You may recall that in our previous broadcast, the previous podcast that we did here on Civic Media, we focused on what I regard as one, if not the major case, having to do with the powers of the presidency, focusing in particular upon two matters. One of them, that Slaughter case, in which the Supreme Court overturned about 90 years of precedent and found that the chief executive, the president of the United States of America, does indeed have the authority, contrary to, again, 90 years of precedent, does have the authority to terminate, to fire, not based solely upon cause, but based even upon whim and political disagreement, members of the leadership of a federal independent agency, and in particular, focusing upon a commissioner named Rebecca Slaughter of the Federal Trade Commission. That is a major case, as we discussed last time, because it changes the way in which the White House can and does have authority over the membership, and presumably also the major decisions of some of the most significant independent agencies, previously established as independent by the Congress of the United States of America. That's the Slaughter case. In the other companion case that we talked about last week, also among the major cases of this term, the Supreme Court in that case involving Lisa Cook, she has been and remains a commissioner of the Federal Reserve Board. And in that case, the Supreme Court, seemingly contrary to the principles or at least the result that it reached in the Federal Trade Commission case, found that the president, at least for now, does not have the capacity to fire Lisa Cook and terminate her position, principally because of what the Supreme Court described as the significant status, kind of sacrosanct position of the Federal Reserve, the importance of the work that it does when it comes to economics, interest rates, and other fiscal matters in the operation of government. So we've got those two cases already out there. We will see how far they spread in terms of precedent with respect to other agencies not traditionally assigned to or a part of the so-called executive branch. Both of those cases, again, under consideration by the Supreme Court, now resolved, adding some life and also some diminution to the concept of the unitary executive theory about which we've described before and discussed in some great detail. This notion that the president should have control of any agency, any administrative body, any unit of government that it is not specifically legislative, like the Congress, or judicial, like the Supreme Court and the lower federal courts. A controversial position, to be sure. It's been out there for a long period of time. It appears that the Supreme Court more and more embracing that particular concept as we go forward. Today on this podcast, we are switching gears. We're going to focus on two additional cases, but with a huge amount of introduction and background, much of which we've talked about before when we were doing live broadcasts, having to do with firearms in America, and in particular, the Second Amendment to the Constitution of the United States of America. I'm going to describe for you some of the historical antecedents of the Second Amendment, how it has historically been understood by the courts, including the Supreme Court, a major change that happened fairly recently in this country, affecting the notion of an individual constitutional right to gun ownership, the expansion of that right, the review of additional cases under some of those recent precedents, and then significantly, a couple of cases just decided in recent terms that add more life and more understanding, if you will, to how the Supreme Court is interpreting the Second Amendment to the Constitution. And finally, at the end of our podcast today, I'm going to talk about one of the cases that the Supreme Court has already designated for review in the next term. And it is a significant one. I would offer it to you more significant than even the cases that it has decided in this past term. All of that inside our analysis today of Supreme Court views and perspectives and understandings of the United States Second Amendment to the Constitution of our nation. What does the Second Amendment say? How was it that James Madison wrote this? Again, addressed by, passed by the first Congress, passed by the now states of the United States as a part of our Bill of Rights. The Second Amendment, as you well know, says this: a well-regulated militia being necessary for the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Let me say that again. It is difficult in our commonplace 21st century language to understand exactly the syntax of that amendment, but let me rephrase it. Let me restate it first. A well-regulated militia being necessary for the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. And the more you read it, the more you understand something about what our founding fathers meant when they wrote those phrases that, again, to our modern ear may sound a bit odd. What were the original positions of our founding fathers? And why did James Madison and others adopt that as the Second Amendment, plainly having to do with the right to keep and bear arms? And then, as I said, we're going to talk about the implications of that language, a significant change in the understanding of that language and its most recent invocations. It was drafted plainly by James Madison and others in 1789, among many other proposed amendments to the Constitution. It was ratified by the requisite number of states in 1791, as were the other components of the Bill of Rights. It was principally meant to prevent tyranny by relying instead on an armed populace as opposed to a standing army. James Madison and others, we know from their letters and readings and the things that they were talking about that time, were very concerned about not revisiting their experience under the British rule and the king in particular. They were not only skeptical, but wanted to push back on the notion of having a standing army, a domestic army in this new nation. And so they said instead that we're concerned about creating a federal tyranny in our present government and having an incarnation of that through the creation of a standing army. It was, as I said, that concept influenced fundamentally by the Revolutionary War experience, where plainly our founding fathers and the initial soldiers were rebelling against Great Britain. And it was also influenced by a lot of these state constitutions that were being enacted at that time. Again, the founding fathers fearful that a powerful central government, this new thing that they're creating, the United States of America, with a very strong standing military, might oppress the citizens, just as had happened during the time of the colonial period, who themselves could best defend against any foreign invasion, which is one of their concerns, and also against domestic unrest. Those were the two focuses. Any domestic unrest and even a foreign invasion, whether it's by Great Britain or other entities out there, other nations, a strong feeling that by ensuring that a militia could be put together, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, that is the way that they would defend this new nation, not by creating a new army, not by establishing what we know today as the Department of Defense, but rather vesting in the people the right to bear arms. For what purpose? To push back on an oppressive government, if that happens, and also to press back against any foreign invasions. That was the concept, as we know today, under the original positions of our founding fathers. It was prompted, again, in part because of these issues related to protection of the nation, but also by things like animal hunting in the new nation, answering some of the practical and physical challenges of frontier living as a nation began to grow in a geographically expanding land. Now, what I just described for you, that is the first understanding of that language, that somewhat curious language of the Second Amendment, that's what the Supreme Court and other lower courts that addressed it embraced and understood for virtually all of our history until June of 2008, fairly recent, June 26th of 2008, the United States Supreme Court for the first time in our history, articulates in a case called District of Columbia versus Dick Heller, H-E-L-L-E-R, a landmark 5-4 ruling. It's a very much split court at the time. The court at that time concluding for the first time in our nation's history, that language of the Second Amendment and the history of the Second Amendment, which is the focus of a lot of what the Supreme Court was talking about, again, on June 26th of 2008, all of that establishes an individual personal right inhering in the individual to bear arms, the right of an individual to keep and bear arms, making this a particular right that is vested in the particular citizen of the United States of America. Not necessarily related to this current concern about militia service or about a foreign entity or even about a domestic concern having to do with a tyrannical government, but rather vesting in individuals for the first time in our history an individual constitutional right to bear arms. And that Supreme Court case in Heller also said that the purpose of that was to ensure a traditional lawful purpose of defending yourself and your family in your home, in a residence, the place of the most supreme privacy that we know today and knew at the time in our nation's history. That was a major change in the way that we understood the Second Amendment, and it happened as recently as June of 2008, and the world has changed a lot since then. It's that case of District of Columbia versus Heller that establishes once again that notion of individual right, a constitutional right to own weapons apart from this notion of supporting a militia if it is needed. Importantly, very importantly, that decision by the Supreme Court, 5-4, it is written by Antonin Scalia, as you probably know. The opinion makes clear that this newly found constitutional right is not unlimited. It's not unconditional. And in fact, does not extend to all weapons in all places at all times. And I've often said that on these broadcasts and our more recent podcasts, that there is no right in America that is unconditional, that is unrestricted, that is without some limitations. And it's true of the Second Amendment as well. There is now a constitutional right to bear arms, but it is subject to all kinds of regulations and restrictions, including, as Justice Scalia told us back in 2008, instances of restrictions on concealed weapons, on the possession by felons or mentally ill people with diminished capacities, carrying weapons in sensitive places like schools and government buildings, limitations on the conditions and qualifications for the commercial sale and transfer and, yes, ownership of guns. That's huge. And it's important to note that Keller, while it changes our understanding of the Second Amendment, also, along with it, establishes all of these things that can be constitutionally done, including, for example, a lot of the debate, a lot of the passage in many states of things like universal background checks and lethal violence protective orders, among other things that limit and condition the use of firearms, the transfer of firearms in America. All that comes from Heller on June 26th of 2008. In the wake of that case, of course, many other decisions coming out of the federal courts across the land. I'm going to skip to the next major Supreme Court case coming out on June 23rd of 2022, just a few years ago. This case is New York State Rifle and Pistol Association versus Bruen, B-R-U-E-N. By a 6-3 vote, again, a split court, the court finds in that case, in Bruen, that a New York law passed by the New York legislature that required that applicants to carry a concealed pistol anywhere in the state of New York, whether it's in Albany or Manhattan, any place in the state of New York, have to show to the government a proper cause or a special need to do so. And that absent that special need, that statement to the government about the reason why you have to carry a concealed pistol, and there could be reasons like your employment, the places that you're going for work or that you inhabit regularly, absent that authorization by the government, you do not have the right to carry a weapon in New York. Well, what happened, of course, is that people, like they did previously, like Dick Keller did in that 2008 case, they came along and said, wait a minute, that limits my Second Amendment right as established in Heller. And indeed, in Bruen, B-R-U-E-N, the United States Supreme Court, in that 6-3 case, it's written by Clarence Thomas, finds that limitation on the capacity of New Yorkers to carry a concealed weapon only based upon authorization by the state government, that's unconstitutional. It is an unconstitutional infringement on the Second Amendment right that was announced first in Heller. And Bruen does two things. Not only does it reaffirm Heller, but it also says that Heller, which again was focused upon the home, the privacy and security of the home, but also upon the capacity of individuals in that home to engage in self-defense, it extends that Heller right to individual possession, a constitutional right to possess and use a weapon outside of the home, into the public domain, our streets and sidewalks. Again, the opinion not only expands the rule in Heller, but the limits of self-defense in a private residence to these public venues, that's very important to understand. It expands that Second Amendment right in ways that, again, we continue to understand and wrestle with to this day. The other major significant thing that Bruen does, and we're going to talk a lot about it, is this. It also requires that in evaluating in the future the constitutionality, the legality, the rightness of any of these so-called restrictions or limitations or stopgaps on the capacity to own and possess and use and transfer and even create firearms, the basis for that, the legislative basis of any of those restrictions, has got to be finding in the past some historical tradition of firearms regulation. Let me say that again. In order to justify today any of those limitations of the sort that the District of Columbia attempted in Heller, that the sort that New York attempted in that Bruen case, you have to go back in time, sometime in the distant past, presumably, and find that there has been some historical tradition of firearms regulation in that same way. Something that it may not be necessarily absolutely the same, we'll get to that, but similar enough to suggest that we've done this before and we are simply extending our understanding of history. That, again, is a significant change in the way that we've always understood this particular right. But Bruen establishes that need for all legislatures and all courts examining legislative actions to look back in time and make determinations based upon past restrictions and whether or not they're applicable to contemporary circumstances. So you have this dual set of cases, Heller and Bruin, 2008 and 2022. And then we've got a series of other cases that we've talked previously about on amicus law review. Let me review those just in fairly summary fashion. A couple of years later, in 2024, there's a case called United States versus Rahimi, R-A-H-I-M-I, decided on June 21st of 2024. And there, by a vote of 8-1, the court concludes that the Second Amendment does not prevent the federal government from prohibiting a person from possessing a firearm, from using a gun in any ways, who was also at the time under a court-ordered restraining order relating to domestic violence. Let me say that again. If the individual is presently subject to a restraining order, you cannot go near another person, typically, not always, but typically because of domestic violence, a partner will come forward into a state court and get a restraining order. You hear about this all the time. If one of those restraining orders is effective as to you or to me, I am then prohibited from having a gun. And we know that because the Congress has passed a statute that says if you are subject to a restraining order, you cannot carry a weapon. And the question in Rahimi, based upon the conduct of Mr. Rahimi, who himself is a very violent individual, he is under a domestic violence restraining order imposed by the state court. He's also using guns routinely in the public domain. The question is that restriction on him, is that constitutional? And the Supreme Court says no. In this case, Mr. Rahimi not entitled to carry a weapon, principally because of his past history. And the justices also begin to understand that this Bruin test doesn't make a whole lot of sense. They begin to refine that Strine test, that very strict test in Bruin, to require only that in assessing the legitimacy of firearms laws like this one that I just described, having to do with people who are subject to a domestic violence restraining order, that courts should compare modern restrictions of this sort to historic traditions, but only through similar analogies or analogs, things that sort of make sense. It doesn't have to be a twin. It doesn't have to be a strict match. And that's the significance of the Rahimi case, number one, indicating that Bruin may not be quite as strident as we thought, and Mr. Rahimi does not get a gun, even in the wake of Heller and Bruin. We've got another case we talked about just last year. It's called Garland versus Vanderstock, V-A-N, capital D-E-R, capital S-T, okay, decided on March 26th of last year by a 7-2 vote. In that case, the court upheld rules of the Biden administration that tightened access to so-called ghost guns. That is, you may know that you can purchase on the web, through the internet these days, weapons kits, the component pieces that can then be used and assembled around your kitchen table, in your basement, in your garage, into untraceable firearms. You get the component pieces through the mail, but it doesn't become operational until you assemble it in your home. Those are called ghost guns. And the question was whether or not the Biden rules through the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and other federal regulations under the Gun Control Act of 1968, can the federal government impose restrictions on those component pieces, including things like serial numbers and the methods of sale of those component pieces? Is the federal government empowered to impose regulations on weapons that meet the definition of firearm? Is that a firearm, that thing, that set of things you get in a box as it shows up at your house? Or is it only a firearm after you assemble it? And the Supreme Court, again, by a majority, 7-2, says that the component pieces there do fall within the category of a firearm. Why? Because you can bring it readily into operational status. And that requires the manufacturers and sellers of those component pieces to be regulated. Nothing unconstitutional about that under Bruin, under Heller. And that includes obtaining licenses and marking their products with serial numbers so that they can be traced during the course of either thefts or violent activities, to conduct background checks when those things are sold, all those kinds of things that otherwise would attend regular firearm sales, all of which is broadly consistent, the Supreme Court says, with this historical antecedent approach in Bruin and the traditional mandates of that case. So we get, again, a further weakening of Bruin in those cases. And that brings us to the two cases of the Supreme Court just in this past term, decided on June 18th and June 25th, just weeks ago. First, a case involving Ali Hemani, H-E-M-A-N-I. The defendant, Mr. Hemani, is charged and he is convicted of a statutory violation, the unlawful possession of a firearm based upon his regular use of marijuana. That is in violation of a section 922 G3 of Title 18 of the United States Code that basically says that if you are a habitual user of a controlled substance, you cannot have a weapon. Once again, a decision made by the United States Congress. And Mr. Hemani, just like others, including Mr. Rahimi a couple of years earlier, he, while he's very cooperative with law enforcement, there's a search at his home, and that search not only reveals a gun, but he also admits that he uses marijuana regularly, and that he's a fairly habitual user of it. And there's marijuana in his home, there's a gun in his home, and the Department of Justice charges him and convicts him of violation of this statute that prohibits someone who is a habitual user of narcotics, of controlled substances like marijuana, of being in violation of the prohibition on gun ownership. The court, invoking both Heller and Bruin, a unanimous court, 9-0, all of them agree, yes, indeed, they do sometimes do that, affirms that Americans hold a constitutional right to keep and bear arms. That's going back, of course, to the language of the Second Amendment. And that in general, prosecutions that infringe on that right are subject to heightened scrutiny. And that's what they apply here. And in particular, Neil Gorsuch, who writes on behalf of the majority, saying that Mr. Hemani's conviction needs to be overturned, principally because the statute here was never intended to address and to go after and acquire and accomplish the conviction of someone like Mr. Hemani, who, yes, may be a habitual user of marijuana, but not the kind of person that the statute was intended to target. The Supreme Court, through the language, through the pen of Neil Gorsuch, who initially says, yes, we appreciate that drugs and guns can sometimes make for a dangerous mix, but the government's invocation here of history, and the government here, the Department of Justice, relying on something called habitual drunkard laws from the history, the court and Gorsuch in particular says that just fails under every message. We don't indeed believe that those measures, those drunkard laws from the past, those do not apply here. And for that reason, they say that in this circumstances, the particular defendant, who is probably not the habitual non-recovering drug addict and using a drug that, again, while it is still illegal both in the state system and the federal system here in Wisconsin, is more and more being legalized around our country. The court says in this case, the application of that statute as to this particular defendant, his use of drugs and his possession of a weapon cannot stand. That is, the conviction against him cannot stand. He is entitled to own a weapon. So they overturn the conviction of Mr. Hemani. Significantly, Judge Gorsuch writes that the opinion is narrow. He says it does not address efforts to ban addicts, people who are non-recovering drug addicts, those presently intoxicated by the drugs that they're using, from possessing a firearm. He goes on to say, nor does it prevent a prosecution when the drug use is deemed to be a danger to the user or others, and that there may be proof that certain types of drugs, for example, heroin or cocaine or methamphetamine, other highly, highly addictive and dangerous drugs can render an individual dangerous. You've got a different set of circumstances, a different defendant, drugs that are more addictive and perhaps involving a particular gun owner whose addiction is not under control, not recovering. Under those circumstances, the statute can be used. And so the Supreme Court does not strike it down, but says in this instance, as it's applied to Mr. Hemani, a sometimes user of marijuana, not in the category of the people intended to be targeted by the statute. That is a major, major case, although again, probably does not have the huge implications of the other cases because of its very narrow application. The statute remains, and Justice Neil Gorsuch's carving out of exceptions is important to understand. On June 25th, then, about a week later of this year, in Wolford versus Lopez, L-O-P-E-Z, the Supreme Court issues its other major case. In response to Bruin and Heller, Hawaii lawmakers, the legislature there, enacted some new restriction on concealed carrying of handguns in their state. And that includes a weapons ban in so-called sensitive places that the legislature identifies, like schools and parks and gas stations and beaches and even shopping malls, and a requirement that, and this is important, that explicit permission from the property owners, who are private property owners, but who are inviting the public onto those properties, you have to get explicit permission from those property owners before you carry your weapons onto that private property open to the public. In other words, explicit permission must be gotten of the private property owner to bring a weapon onto the private land, even though the access to it is public. Plaintiffs in the case argued that these no-carry limitations of this type infringe on the otherwise broad and strong protections that we saw in places like Heller and Bruin, and that they also violate the fundamental intent that Scalia identified in Heller. Defendants, of course, say that the law protects private property rights, and if individual property owners want to do that, it is their right to do that, and we should defer to their decision-making, to the owner's choice about allowing weapons on the premises. By a 6-3 order, June 25th of 2026, authored by Justice Sam Alito, the court ruled that the state law, this is the language, violates the constitutional right to keep and bear arms because it, according to the court, hobbles what the Second Amendment protects. That is the right of Americans to carry arms for self-defense as they go about their daily lives. Let me repeat that. That this particular Hawaiian restriction, that is the requirement that individuals who are carrying a weapon get explicit permission from the private property owners before bringing those guns onto that publicly invited land, that hobbles the Second Amendment right and affects the ability of Americans to defend themselves as they go about their daily lives. That language, an awful lot banding about by those folks who embrace, again, a second decision of the Supreme Court that does further uphold gun rights. According to, again, the dissenters, as we've seen in other cases, they are Ketanji Brown Jackson, Elena Kagan, and Sonia Sotomayor. They say the objective of the majority here, including Sam Alito, is protecting guns, not consistently preserving any principle of law. They note that Hawaii does, in fact, have this long Bruin-like history of protecting and having tight gun restrictions, so protecting the safety and security of its population. The history and tradition test is met, they say, and for that reason, they would have upheld the Hawaii law. But once again, the importance of this is that particular case, the Lopez case, again, requiring express permission by the property owner, by an individual owner and user and carrying a weapon, to go on to that quasi-public, quasi-private property. There is nothing significantly about the decision in Lopez that prevents a private property owner, including someone who's responsible for schools and parks and hospitals and beaches and shopping malls, other places, again, that may be privately owned, privately administered, but in which the public is invited to come, nothing that prevents the leadership, the management of those places from placing on the front doors and the windows, as we've often seen, those express statements that guns are not permitted here. They are prohibited and do not carry them on these properties. Those statements, those express denials of permission to bring weapons on, those are still constitutional. And so when you see them about in our communities, they do not run afoul of this recent decision. It's only in those cases where those signs are not there that the Supreme Court says that, well, someone who's carrying a concealed weapon still has to get express permission. Here, in the instances of those signs, what has happened is the property owners have beaten you to the punch, and they've said, we are expressly telling you we will not give you permission. You're not permitted to do that, and nothing about Lopez, again, means that you cannot bring your weapons, that you can bring your weapons onto those properties without any violation of the Second Amendment. And so those two cases in Lopez and Hernandez, significant, but fairly narrow in their application. Let me talk now about yet another case coming out of the Supreme Court, not in this term, but almost certainly in the coming term. As I indicated, the Supreme Court has already begun to populate the next term, the 2026-2027 term, with cases, and it has begun to identify those matters that are controversial, including about 3 weeks ago now, they identified that they will in fact be taking up, they've granted a writ of certiorari in two cases involving bans on semi-automatic weapons, AR-15 type weapons. And that's what the jurisdictions in places like Cook County, Illinois, and the entire state of Connecticut have done recently. Plainly, state of Connecticut, in the wake of the horrific Sandy Hook mass shooting there of a number of years ago, the Newtown disaster, the catastrophe, that state imposes a complete ban on semi-automatic weapons, including AR-15 type weapons, as does Cook County, Illinois. And the question is, in the wake of all these cases, including Heller and Bruin, how far does a legislature have capacity to ban semi-automatic weapons of this sort? In a 2025 opinion that we just talked about, the Supreme Court already identified these weapons as the most popular rifle in the country. Advocates for them have written that they are used for hunting and target shooting and self-defense, and they indicate that they're not intended to be weapons of war to mow people down. People on the other side, including the legislatures that have banned them, have said that indeed these are not used and not useful for self-defense just because they're marketed broadly. They're weapons of choice for criminal acts for quickly massacring innocents, rarely put to lawful public use. And it is significant, therefore, that in these cases, the Supreme Court is going to be hearing in the coming term that the United States Supreme Court continues its focus not only on guns and its interpretation of the Second Amendment, again, passed way back in the late 18th century, but on continuing to define what is not within the ambit of permissible gun regulation, ownership, transfer, possession, use, all those kinds of things. I would offer from perspective that the Himani case and the Lopez case, again, narrow applications in this past term, are far going to be eclipsed by what the Supreme Court does in connection with the capacity of individuals in America to own and use semi-automatic rifles. That is another standard. That is another level of Supreme Court analysis that we'll look forward to, perhaps not with anticipation, but nonetheless with focus on the intellectual analysis it provides in that particular kind of case. Again, the Supreme Court may add more firearms cases, as it certainly will. It has somewhere between 40, maybe even 50 more cases to add to its docket before it begins to undertake its review of this and other cases. And that brings us to the conclusion of this installment of Amicus Law Review. We're going to continue over the next couple of podcasts to continue to review some of the major cases. And yes, indeed, that includes things in which the President of the United States of America was handed some defeats, in particular in the areas of tariffs and international economic authority, and also, of course, in the area of 14th Amendment birthright citizenship. We're also going to be revisiting some cases under the First Amendment that the Supreme Court has issued, and of course, some LGBTQIA issues that are also a part of its decisional docket of just this past term. All of that and more coming up on future editions, future installments of Amicus Law Review here on Civic Media. I invite you to continue to tune in, be a part of our exploration of these cases and others on this broadcast. I thank you once again for your attention, your focus, and your intellectual inquiries about what is going on in the areas of the rule of law, the administration of justice, and the operation of government, including the Supreme Court, in 2026. Thank you, everyone.